This is Pamela Kuhn, and the curtain is up on Center Stage, the show about the arts and the artists behind their work. If I say North American Indigenous Songbook, are any of my listeners familiar with its existence or the music of Native Americans? If I ask, how many of you know the names of prominent Native American and First Nation composers, what will you say? In the world of Native Americans, or as I will refer to, the First People, there are a great many undiscovered giants in the classical and popular music world. Composer Raven Chacon is a Diné artist who became the first Native American to win a Pulitzer Prize in music. Joy Harjo is a Muscogee Creek poet and composer. As a multidisciplinary artist, she is the first Native American to become the 23rd Poet Laureate of the United States. Yvonne Russo is a powerful voice in the storytelling world as an award-winning film director, producer, and writer in television and film. She is a proud member of the Sikangu Lakota Tribal Nation and director of the film Viva Verdi, amongst many others. Today, I have with me another tribal member, Timothy Long. Maestro Long has lived the life force of music from his early childhood. He is now artistic and music director of opera at the Eastman School of Music. He has worked on the conducting staff at the Metropolitan Opera, Wolf Trap, Opera Theater of St. Louis, and New York City Opera, just to name a few. In 2017, he conducted the world premiere of Missing, the groundbreaking work by Marie Clements and Brian Current about the 5,000-plus missing Indigenous women in Canada. He is passionate about his work with the Plimpton Foundation, which promotes the work of Native, Indigenous, and underrepresented Americans through scholarships and commissions. As you are about to learn, Timothy Long is a very special and compelling artist. Timothy Long, welcome to Center Stage. You are the first Native American guest that I have had on my show. It is a thrill.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me, Pamela.
Of course. What an honor. A guy like you at the Eastman School, it feels to me like it may have been a long road for you. How did you come to music?
Well, as you know, every road in classical music is long. It takes many, many years of training and understanding. And I think the payoff is incredible if you sustain a life of music. I grew up in southeastern Oklahoma at the bottom part of the Creek Nation. And I am the first generation in my family to have English as a first language. So my father was full-blood Muscogee Creek. My mom is full-blood Choctaw. And we grew up in a very mixed area between whites and mainly Muscogee Creeks in that area. And it is very unusual, the path that I took, but it originated in my mom's story. My mother grew up in far eastern Oklahoma in poverty, really, really rural area. Then she ended up being sent to a boarding school, an Indian boarding school, until she was in high school and she caught tuberculosis before there was treatment. She was then sent to an Indian tuberculosis sanatorium for 5 years, where she was in quarantine for most of the time. It was a really tragic upbringing that she had. But there were things that were created in her life that affected me greatly. The first one was that in this Tallahena, Oklahoma sanatorium, she said everybody was listening to country and Western music, and she got sick of the twang. So she came across a classical station and she began listening to classical music. So she was told to never have children because she had a lung removed and they felt she was too weak, but she did. And when she and my father had me, they were only listening to Beethoven. So it's really, really unusual, you would think, for anybody in my small town to be listening to Beethoven when they're a toddler, but especially for a Native American kid to be listening to Beethoven. So I had that combined with going to a Muscogee Creek church called Salt Creek Indian Church. And at that church, my grandfather was the minister. It was filled with my relatives. Everything was done in the Muscogee Creek language, but I saw my first piano there. My distant aunt, Hetty Long, was the church pianist, and I used to sit and watch her fingers go into the keyboard. While at home, I was obsessively listening to music, and then Hetty became my babysitter. And then I got a toy piano at three, and I was obsessively playing it. And finally, my mother, who worked at the local high school, met a 15-year-old girl, and she was from a very poor family. But she played the piano really well and she sang really well and she wanted to start teaching. So I became her very first student. She was 15 and I was 5. And I am so lucky to have had her because she instilled in me a love for music and it was like playtime all the time. I never felt like I had to practice or that things had to be. I played movie music, I played pop music, I played classical music. Most pivotal thing was that she started me on theory before I could read words. I had a theory coloring book, if you can imagine that. And I remember my mother, who didn't know anything about music, would read the question to me, and there was a blank keyboard, and I would color in the answer with crayons. Isn't that brilliant?
This is amazing.
I
At
love
such a
it.
young age, a theory coloring book. I love
Yes,
that.
I
If
do
only we
too.
could have all been so lucky.
Yes. Exactly, because so many people learn theory later, in their teenage years or in college. But when you start at that age, you slowly, slowly, slowly build a deep understanding of what it really means,
How
not just
music
the
works.
surface, but the guts of music.
Yeah, the form, the structure, for such a young mind, that's so important at that point.
And in addition to that, I am convinced that listening to a composer like Beethoven, who was a great musical philosopher, teaches your brain how to hear patterns, how to recognize patterns, how to hear structure. So you are absorbing the knowledge of these centuries when you listen to music like that as a young age. And it affected me deeply.
How does that stay with you now when you hear Beethoven?
Well, I revere Beethoven. I revere so many of the German composers so much that I almost don't want to perform them. I started music because it was such a personal thing. I was enraptured by it, and it started as something that was really, really private to me. And I still have that desire to keep certain things very private. Like Bach, I love Bach. I don't want to perform Bach. I want to keep Bach for me.
For
And a lot
yourself,
of them, yeah, a lot of them are still that same way. But in addition to that, and I didn't really know the word for this until I got older, but I had very strong synesthesia as a child, and that was a big key to my connection with music, and it's still with me. I had very strong perfect pitch as a child. I had a little bit of photographic memory, so I had a lot of neurodivergence going on with my relationship with music. And that combination is really the key to what has happened in my life.
So, besides that coloring book, you had all the colors of the rainbow going on in your world, that private world of yours, which must have been so precious to you. Did you see the musical notes in colors with your synesthesia?
No, there are many different forms of synesthesia. And for those who don't know, it's basically when you experience one sense through another. And for me, it is visual to sound. So I have it with the spellings of names, even to this day. When I was a child, the way it exhibited itself was through my Hot Wheels and Matchbox cars. My parents, said I would sit in my bedroom for hours in silence, and they just thought I was a really good kid. So I'm glad I had that perception. But you know what I was doing? I was sitting there with my cars, and I still have them, and I can still hear them. Based on their color, their shape, and their mat, they denoted timbre. And my sister played the flute, so they played the flute, and it affected their vibrato speed, the clarity of their sound, their inherent technical successes and deficiencies. It told me everything. And I would be sitting there with my cars in a row in front of me, going one by one, hearing them play in an audition in my head. And that was the greatest, greatest thing. I loved it. Here's another bit of neurodivergence. I can memorize lists of names, long lists of names, through synesthesia. So the names denote quality, and I memorize the quality. So I used to memorize lists of programs when I was younger. Today, I memorize every person's name in the orchestra that I conduct, so I know who they are. But back then, it happened that I would save names that I found interesting, and I would look at programs and find names that just spoke to me. And then I started creating names. So I had a list of around 200 names that represented people throughout the world. This sounds crazy. I know it sounds crazy. But remember, it's synesthesia, and this was all in my head. I would choose maybe 100 names at a time. And by this point, they were violinists. And I thought, well, this is not fair that they have to play the same piece. So I would let them choose their own piece based on their name, which denoted many qualities. Again, vibrato, it told me how they held their violin because people hold them differently. It told me about how their bow speed was on the violin. So I would divide myself up into five different judges with different perspectives. I would listen to each name play an audition in my head. And as five different judges, I would give them number scores. I would go through a list of about 100. At the end of the day, I would take my calculator and tally up the scores. And it was like the greatest Christmas that you've ever had. So I was never bored by myself.
No.
And I still am not, because I still have a lot of things going through my mind.
Were you able to impart all of this visualization to your parents?
Only when I was an adult. Because again, as a child, I think we all have a desire to fit in. And all of these things that are so close to me felt bizarrely different. So I didn't want anybody to know. But yeah, when I got older, I told them. I tell the story all the time now because I think it is a real key to how I look at music and how important it is to me.
And you've just spoken about something very important with synesthetes, that there is a personality, there is a texture, there is a warmth, there is that feeling that we embody ourselves with. I am very much a synesthete. And I used to think, Tim, I used to think that everyone was. I didn't think I was odd. I thought, oh, we can all see in this
Yes.
way. And then you realize that it is a singular process. And
Yes.
yeah,
Well,
it's an interesting thing for artists.
you said something that is key to me that I did not say, and I still am dissecting it, to be honest. You said feeling, and that is the biggest key to me because as I grew up, I played around 10 different instruments, and today I still play violin and viola a bit, and piano, of course. But I've been trying to really break down how I learned instruments because they were easy for me. And what I discovered was it's because of synesthesia, I would hear music that would give me an emotion, a deep emotion. And you can really feel it inside of you. And because of that emotion, I had the desire to create that emotion. And so I would learn an instrument in order to feel and create that emotion, not learn the instrument. And when you go in from that route, you skip a lot of steps in advancing. So you can learn to play very quickly. For example, I taught myself violin at around 15 and a half, and my only goal was to play two measures of the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto, the end of the second movement, because I grew up listening to this incredible recording of Zeno Francescatti playing it. And I remember his sound and vibrato that was just rapturous, and I wanted to experience that. So I taught myself violin for those two measures. And when you do that, everything else falls into place.
That is so extraordinary. If only we could all be blessed with that feeling of jubilation, in seeking out the connection with an instrument. And I'm sure many do, even those who sit in the practice room and just diligently play notes. And I'd read that you were quite introverted
Yes,
when you.
introverted and shy and blunt at the same time. And I think I was a combination of those all my life. My mother, as you can imagine from what she went through, learned to be very stoic and independent, and she kind of learned she couldn't rely on people. So she didn't have a need for friends when we were growing up. She was just pretty stoic. My father was ebullient. So I'm a combination of the two. On the outside, I'm like my father, but on the inside, I'm very much like my mother. And
Okay.
I had to learn how to step it up when I moved to New York, because on the Muscogee Creek side, which is where I grew up, one of our inherent qualities is using very few words. So there's a lot of silence.
Oh,
We're not afraid of
really?
silence. I think what I call the American vernacular is that you're supposed to fill up every silence so that people aren't uncomfortable. We use
Example.
silence a lot. And so when I moved to New York, I realized if I spoke the way I did in Oklahoma, nobody would hear me. So I learned to speak the American vernacular, and I kind of do it more naturally now. But at first, I would mimic my husband, Chris, and I would make my voice a roller coaster. It goes up, it goes down. I keep doing this and I end with a smile, you know?
I love that. I
Yeah.
love that. Oh, we learn from the greatest examples around us. I mean,
Yes, exactly.
because that is one of my questions today for you to have gone from this profound existence in Eastern Oklahoma, to the Big Apple and stepping into a conductor's shoes, which is very much the team player. Here we've taken this shy kid living in your own fantastic world of just radiance, it sounds like,
Yes.
as a synesthete. But similar to Jackson Pollock, who's also a synesthete, of course, throwing out the color, you were able to form fit into this new world in the world of music in New York City.
I have to tell you, it's only in the last few years that my own mind has caught up with that. It
Interesting.
wasn't until 7 or 8 years ago that I think I still had the mindset that I had as a teenager in Oklahoma,
Yeah.
that I wasn't really a part of everything.
That's incredibly candid. I love that. Yeah.
Well, it's true. And then, you go through all these successes and you diminish the successes when you have
Yeah.
that mindset.
Yeah.
Something that you may have dreamed of all of your life becomes just average in your mind. And so sometimes it takes work for you to sort of see your own place in this profession in music. And now I do feel my place, certainly. But I've been, as I said before, it was such a personal relationship. So I never really had big goals or dreams. I didn't think dreams were in my future. So I just enjoyed each incredible moment with my synesthesia and music, and that brought me to where I am.
That was enough. I adore this. I adore your honesty. But yet, I think at age 16, you actually played with the Oklahoma Symphony, was it?
I did, yes.
You did your debut.
I did. I've had a million miracles in my life and wonderful people. So when I was age 12, my first piano teacher realized that I had abilities and talent, but she didn't know how to take me to the next level. So being the good person that she was, she set up an audition with the teacher whose students beat her in all the competitions. And this was a woman in Oklahoma City named Ernestine Scott, who was really the most successful piano teacher in the state. She had incredible players. And I didn't want to go. I was mad. I didn't want to go. But I went, and she said she had no room before we set it up. And then my first teacher said, please hear him, at least hear him. So we went and I played an audition. And after my audition, she immediately said, what night works best for you? And she started moving her schedule around. And because we drove 1.5 hours each way, she would give me the 2 to 3 hour lessons at the end of the day. And she was
Wow.
brutally honest, which I loved, because I always hated being treated like a child, and she treated me like an adult at age
Okay.
12 and changed everything for me. So imagine I went from age 12, where I had no structure, really not much technique. And by 14, she had me, by 16, she had me playing with the Oklahoma Symphony, and it was the Rhapsody in Blue. I'd won a competition to play with them,
Fabulous.
and she has been key to my life.
I love hearing about these kind of moments.
Oh my
It's what
gosh.
ignites a young musician's world.
And without these starter teachers, where would any of us be, you
That's
know?
right. That's right. Oh, I haven't forgotten one of them myself. And it's so important, in our journey that we reflect back on that,
Yes.
especially now. It's key in the world of the arts and in life. It makes us the people we are.
Exactly. And I have a photo of her right next to my piano here at Eastman. She's at her piano, and in her will, I got one of her Steinways, so that's sitting in my home here in Rochester.
Oh,
And all of those things just mean so much.
how perfect. And it's extraordinary, just these little moments, Tim. This is what defines us.
It's true, and I play my toy piano so much that my dad had to put some wooden reinforcement on it because of me beating it up. And I don't know if you remember, this is early 70s. A lot of the cars had punch keys for the air conditioner and for the radio. And
Yes,
I would
yes.
sit in between my parents and play on those like a keyboard. So I was constantly trying to play piano, and that's why they asked me finally if I wanted lessons.
Let's tame these active fingers and this
Oh.
imagination. I love it. I absolutely love it. So, when was that moment when you knew you could turn your direction towards music and make it your life force, as in surviving by it financially?
Well, as you know, this is going to be an entire talk about synesthesia, which I love. I've never done
Hey, I'm all for
it.
it.
I love it because it's like my best friend in a way. And I know
is.
people won't understand it necessarily, but it was from a young age, it was like an addiction to me. Before I was double digits, I had a recording of the ballet by Respighi, La Boutique Fantasque, which is based on Rossini themes. And it was just, I can't, it took me to another world. I would come home from school and I would be running to my room to put on recordings so that it felt like when I heard some of this music, I could finally breathe. So it was so important to me. I've always wondered if it equals to like a dopamine addiction or something, you know?
Interesting.
Because it changes you on the inside. You have this excitement. And it was so connected and deep that I never made a choice to go into music. It was going to be. And there was no question, not even a moment where I questioned if I was going to do this. I never knew on what level, and I was going to accept whatever level it was. I could still be in Oklahoma, in my hometown, playing music, and that would have been enough for me. And I'm just so fortunate that things happened the way they did.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And you went to New York City in what year? How old were you?
Well, I went to Rochester, where I am now. I was 22. I did my undergraduate degree at Oklahoma City University, which was
Okay.
a great school. My teacher taught there. I was concert master of the orchestra. I played in the Oklahoma City Philharmonic. I got to play concertos. We had a great class. If you can imagine, one of my classmates was Kristen Chenoweth because we had a wonderful musical theater and opera program. So it was ideal for me. And honestly, I don't think I would have been ready to go to New York at age 18.
Okay.
So I ended up going to Eastman for my master's degree in piano when I was 22. And then I didn't know what I was going to do, so I started the doctorate in piano. But in between these two degrees, I went to the Aspen Music Festival as a student. I studied with the great Anne Shine, who had studied with Arthur Rubinstein. And oh my God, I just loved her. But a friend of mine told me you could get a full fellowship if you auditioned for opera and they took you. And I did that. And I got a full fellowship to Aspen and I played for opera while I was studying piano and I fell in love. First of all, you can imagine as somebody like me who is sort of shy but blunt, I loved being around singers because singers just had big personalities, which kind of drew me out. I loved the stories. I loved the music. I loved the communal aspect of creating something. So I came back to Eastman. I got the opera assistantship to play for opera. I ignored all of the doctoral curriculum and I started taking diction classes, opera classes, everything towards vocal music. And I took probably three or four incompletes in the doctoral seminars. I have some great paper titles that never got written. So, because I was just focusing on the music, you know?
You were
And
focusing on what turned you on and what you
yes,
knew you had to do, right?
exactly. And I probably wasn't so good with authority anyway. But so I stayed for 2 years. I learned what I wanted to learn. And then I just left town. I didn't withdraw, I didn't tell them. I just left. And I got an associate coach position at Juilliard. So I moved to New York. I began working at Juilliard and freelancing. And I wasn't even a conductor yet. I was playing piano and coaching, and I could sight read really well. And after years of practicing intense technique, it was very easy for me. So I had a great time in New York in the 90s. I was pretty wild. I was pretty lost as a person. But as with every era of my life, the thing that kept focus was music.
Yeah.
And music, no matter what was going on for me personally, how confused I may have been, music kept pulling me through this line where I kept advancing with jobs, with university jobs, and finally to conducting.
Wow, that's what it does, that musical world.
Yes.
So you just answer the call of your instincts all the
Yes.
time?
Yes, because you know, my father, it's interesting. When I was about five, and I have this book. This is why I know this. There was a tiny high school called Bing High School, BYNG, which is outside of Ada, Oklahoma. And they decided to do a little book that told stories of local Creek and Seminole people.
Okay.
And they interviewed my parents, and my parents talk about my sister and me. And in it, I'm five. And he talks about he didn't want us to be the stereotypical Indian kids of being seen but not heard. You know, we were shy. When we'd go trick-or-treating, we'd have our giant plastic pumpkins. And if there wasn't a white kid with us, we could not even utter trick-or-treat. We would just hold out our pumpkins with our little brown hands coming out of our costumes in silence. So my father made a concerted effort to help us to assimilate. We started alternating with a white church between the Creek and the white church.
Very
He
good.
started taking us to many things. And in this book, he said he wanted us to be outspoken, articulate, and passionate. And so, in a way, they never reined me in. I never had rules. I never had chores. I never had to study. I never had to practice. I never had a curfew. They taught me to only do what I wanted to do and what I felt like doing. And I
Right.
think in retrospect, that was kind of an armor that he was giving me, knowing that a little Indian kid going out into the white world at that time needed a lot of strength.
Timothy Long is a sensitive and extraordinary man, and as you have heard, one who has continually listened to his inner voice for guidance. I hope you will join us next week on Center Stage as we continue to speak about his life's journey as a conductor and the riches that he shares about his personal life. For more information, please go to timothylongmusic.com. And I hope you'll look for the complete unedited film version of this interview at centerstagewithpamelacoon.com. To all my listeners out there, stay safe. This is Pamela Coon, and the curtain is now down on Center Stage.